Welcome back to the Sports Docs Podcast. I'm Dr. Ashley Bassett.
And I'm Dr. Catherine Logan.
And on each episode, we chat about the most recent developments in sports medicine with experts from around the country. In this episode, we're going to continue our discussion with Dr. Andrea Spiker and focus on open surgical treatment for hip preservation, then wrap up with a discussion on post-op rehab and return to play.
Our conversation picks back up with an article from the September 2017 issue of AJSM titled, Early Functional Outcomes of Periacetabular Osteotomy After Failed Hip Arthroscopic Surgery for Symptomatic Acetabular Dysplasia. Brian Kelly and his team at HSS investigated the effect of prior arthroscopic hip surgery on clinical outcomes after periacetabular osteotomy, or PAO. They found that patients who previously underwent hip arthroscopy had inferior functional outcomes at 6 months and 12 months after PAO compared to patients with no prior hip surgery. The authors note that both groups significantly improved post-op, and there was no difference in complications or reoperation between the groups.
We finish up today with a surgical technique article authored by our guest, Dr. Andrea Spiker, from the August 2022 issue of Arthroscopy Techniques. The article is titled, Treatment of Coxa Profunda with Open Surgical Hip Dislocation, Rim Resection, Cam Resection, and Labral Reconstruction, and describes an open surgical approach to address many of the challenges posed by coxa profunda. For our listeners, coxa profunda, which we'll put a diagram or a picture of it here, it's essentially a deep acetabular socket, and this differs from acetabular protrusion, in which the femoral head and socket actually displace into the pelvis. This global acetabular overcoverage is associated with coxa profunda, and that makes arthroscopic management very challenging in terms of obtaining adequate hip distraction and concerns for traction injury. And for these reasons, an open approach has been proposed. Are you one of the many surgeons who thinks that getting osteochondral allografts is a complex and time-consuming process? Well, you're not alone. But we're excited to tell you that there is a simpler way.
At JRF Ortho, they get it. They've heard your concerns and made it their goal to simplify the process. They're not just any company. They are leaders in fresh osteochondral allografts, holding over 60% of the global market share.
JRF Ortho is committed to accommodating your needs, delivering allografts usually around 30 days, and it's all on your terms. You choose your scheduling option, whether it's specifying a surgical date, providing a date range, or just requesting the earliest available allograft. Your preferences are their top priority.
And there's more. They offer pre-sutured tendons and meniscus, and ordering is as easy as a few clicks on their user-friendly online ordering system.
So why make it complicated when you can make it JRF Ortho easy? Simplify your allograft procurement today. Your journey to seamless osteochondral allografts starts with JRF Ortho. To learn more, visit jrforth.org. Welcome back to the show, Andrea. So we're going to shift our conversation now to open surgical treatment for hip preservation. So starting with periacetabular osteotomy for hip dysplasia. But first, kind of like what we did for FAI, we want to get a quick overview of adult hip dysplasia. So for our listeners, what is that? What is hip dysplasia? How do patients typically present? And what does your workup look like?
So Ashley, you started us off with another hard question.
I'm full of them. These are all hard questions.
Right? Yes. You guys are doing great. It's like you're right in the hip world. You know exactly. So, you know, hip dysplasia technically is a radiographic diagnosis. It is a lateral center edge angle less than 25 degrees on I do a standing AP pelvis x-ray. So that's technically the answer. It's LCEA less than 25 degrees. And the other component is hip instability. So hip instability is more of a clinical diagnosis and has to do with, is the ball completely stable inside the socket during physiological motion or physiologic motion? And sometimes you can have hip instability with a normal lateral center edge angle. So that's where it gets tricky. So when I meet a patient who comes in, a lot of times I'm meeting them for evaluation of a hip arthroscopy. So they've never before been diagnosed with hip dysplasia. I measure their AP pelvis x-rays, and I'm the first person to ever tell them that they have hip dysplasia. And this is also applying to patients who have pretty severe undercoverage of the hip socket. And so, you know, why is this missed? You know, I think part of it is that I see a lot of former athletes, and if there's a strong muscular envelope around the hip, that protects them from feeling that like diagnosis of hip instability. You know, it really kind of holds the hip and socket. And as we age, as we get into our 20s, 30s, 40s, they're no longer competitive athletes. That muscle envelope gets a little bit weaker. And suddenly now they're symptomatic of the fact that they don't have that acetabular coverage.
And exam wise, what do you find most useful to sort of help you undercover that?
So the exam maneuvers, and there's a lot of them in the hip, they tend to be non-diagnostic. So when you have dysplasia, you know, the labrum tears because there's a lot of edge loading. Sometimes the labrum will hypertrophy and be a little bit more prone to tearing, or there's cartilage flaps. And so a lot of those same impingement maneuvers that we do for hip impingement are positive. So the fader, flexion, adduction, internal rotation, Faber, subspine impingement can be positive. There are a few exam maneuvers. The prone apprehension relocation test is one that I use. There's an axial distraction test. There's all of these tests specifically for instability. But again, the exam itself doesn't really help you all that much. It's I think, much more related to the radiographs and then the history. So one of the things that helps me differentiate an impingement patient from a dysplasia patient or an instability patient is the dysplasia or instability patient will say it just hurts all the time. So they sit too long, they stand too long. There's positive high heel signs. So if they get into high heels, it tilts their pelvis in a way that can undercover their hips a little bit more, and they feel more pain with that. Oh. And so more of that global, like everything hurts, is consistent with dysplasia.
Say this is why we need more women in orthopedics, because you discovered that that's fantastic. And so many female patients have hip dysplasia and that would never be recognized, but now that gets recognized. So that's awesome. Yeah. Awesome. So we want to talk a little bit about surgery. So PAO, can you walk us through your approach to a PAO, your surgical technique, fixation? Talk to us like we haven't seen one in a long time because we haven't.
Wait, you're not doing them every week?
No, but you know, just last week I did one yet.
Okay. So, you know, the PAO looks and sounds like a really scary surgery, but it's really not that bad. So we can do it through a very small bikini incision, really cosmetic, you know, sometimes 6 to 8 centimeter incision, and we can do everything inside the pelvis through that incision. So first it's a bikini incision. I'll elevate the sartorius with a little tiny bone wafer. So it's a muscle sparing technique. So we don't cut through any of the muscles. And then you can elevate the iliacus off the inside of the pelvic brim and go all the way down to the rectus. And then what we do is we keep the rectus attached, develop the plane kind of medial to the rectus, and follow the pubic rim toward the pubic symphysis and elevate the iliopsoas medially. And then that allows us to make the first of the 4 cuts. So we make a cut in the, you know, the very lateral portion of the superior pubic ramus. And then you can slide an osteotome kind of around the inferior aspect of the femoral neck over the capsule down to the ischium. So the front of the ischium, we cut halfway through the ischium. And then we can go back up, protect the abductors as we saw the superacetabular cut. And then we will take an osteotome down the posterior column and complete that fragment, which is just the acetabular fragment. The nice thing about the PAO is you don't completely disrupt the pretzel pelvic ring. The posterior column is still intact. And that's what allows patients to, you know, put a decent amount of weight through it right when we're done. So then after that fragment's mobilized, we rotate it into the correct position, and then we put 4 screws in. I put 4 screws in. Some people do 3 or 2 or other amounts, and then we let them heal. Patients typically stay in the hospital for 1 night. We get them PT. I get them a CPM right away to get that hip moving. And it is remarkable rounding on these patients, even post-op day 0 or post-op day 1, they look so comfortable. Most people are on their phones, texting, calling. And we do a regional block right around the osteotomy cuts at the end of surgery, which seems to be working really well for pain control. But I think the other part of it is that that acetabular fragment is wedged into the graft site of the pelvis. It's stable and their hip is covered. And so a lot of people will say, yes, I have surgical pain, but my hip feels better than it did before.
I still think, like you said, oh, it's really easy. I don't think that sounds easy. But you explain the anatomy very elegantly, and it does. It makes it seem attractive to do. And I'm sure Ashley
you know, appreciates. It's like, oh yeah, you just, you know, peel this down, do this, do this, do this. You know, it's really neat anatomy around the hip. And I think, you know, who knows, maybe you'll turn us, but
yes.
I think,
Catherine, I don't know if while you were listening to that, I was having like some flashbacks to Children's. So Catherine, I looked at our chief, like, at Boston Children's Hospital, and that's where I saw any of the PAOs. That's where, you know, doing that and grounding on them. And you're right, thinking back, like, I mean, I always thought because they're kids, right? So they're so young, like kids are so tough, but they weren't terribly uncomfortable, like when you saw them rounding on the wards. So, so that's very interesting. But I was getting flashbacks to that technique
Matheny.
When you were talking about.
I don't know. Yeah. That's what I was thinking about. Travis Matheny. I don't know.
Yes.
Yeah. And I actually, I don't know if the YouTube viewers will appreciate this. We did a study for a while where we were pre-op printing our patients' pelvises. So this is actually one of my patients' pelvises. Nice. And so you can see the cuts that we make, and you can see how that posterior column is intact. So we don't cut through it all the way. And then you can just really take that and kind of move it wherever you need to give it the coverage that they need. So it's pretty cool.
And no, that's so helpful, not even for our viewers, but for me.
Now, like when you're, because you were talking about your 3D printing it. So when like for me, if I'm doing a TTO for realignment, I'm figuring out exactly how much distalization and medialization I need. And I'm going in with that number in my mind and I check it with x-rays. So are you templating exactly how much you're going to move, exactly how much that wedge is going to be for each patient based on their calculations?
We aren't. There's a number of software companies that are coming out with templating products that could allow us to do that. But at this point, it's a lot more of once you get the fragment in place, we do temporary fixation, and then we're looking at a few things. We're looking at the lateral center edge angle. Does it have enough lateral coverage? The tonus angle is probably the second most important radiographic measurement, and that's looking at the kind of the tilt of the acetab, you know, the source seal. Does it tilt up? Is it kind of flat? So we're looking at the tonus angle. We're looking at anterior wall coverage. You want it to kind of skim the front of the or the top of the femoral head. We're looking at the posterior wall. We want it at least halfway covering, you know, the femoral head. We're looking at joint medialization. So we're looking at antiversion of the hip socket. So there's all these things that we check on fluoro, and I can't tell you how many times you get it into place and then you get that fluoro shot and you're like, nope, I need more antiversion. You twist it, undo it, redo it again. So at this point, I'm doing more of a, what does the x-ray look like right now? But it is interesting that there, I think I'm seeing more and more of that templating software creep up.
Yeah, very interesting.
Pretty cool. I'm sure I would think like your patients really enjoy seeing the 3D printing too. It just really is like a great visual for them to understand, hey, this is what's going on and this is why your hip's going to feel different. And I think all of that is obviously useful in surgery. But I think what I've noticed with any of that stuff is patients are like much better able. It's like you can kind of take them through an MRI or whatever, but it's just sort of, it's very hard to wrap your head around. So.
Yeah, I did an entire hip preservation fellowship to wrap my head around it.
Yeah.
After my sports fellowship. So.
So there's also, and we kind of touched on this a little bit, but there's a high frequency of intra-articular pathology in that same setting of hip dysplasia. So whether it's labral tear, cartilage lesion, how do you sort of address those? You know, do you do combined PAO scope? Do you separate those? Do you prioritize one? You know, how do you sort of distill all that down?
So Catherine, that's actually a really controversial topic in the hip world.
Yeah.
So my personal preference, I'm hip arthroscopy trained, you know, and I'm hip preservation PAO trained. And so I do everything at once on the same table. I use the Stryker Guardian table, and that allows me to do the hip scope, and I don't even have to redrape. I just move right on to the PAO.
Wow.
And so we close the portals and then I make the PAO incision. And so it doesn't add much time. And my personal thought is there's a lot of literature out there showing that patients will get better with PAO. The PAO is actually this incredibly powerful operation because we do have long-term data. You know, unlike the hip arthroscopy patients, which we are just now starting to get, but in the PAO literature, we have long-term data that shows us that we can change the natural history of hip dysplasia. And that natural history is that patients with dysplasia are at a 5 times higher risk of getting a hip replacement before the age of 50 if they have hip dysplasia than if they don't. But if you do a PAO, that risk goes away. Okay. So PAO is super powerful. And the nice thing is that you give them their own native joint and they can do whatever they want with it. There's no restrictions and they could potentially avoid getting a hip replacement. So the PAO is really powerful. But and I know they get better after a PAO alone, but I've had a number of patients who've had a PAO and they come to me because they are better, but they're not perfect. Okay. And so what I do is I fix their labrum and they're like, yes, that was it. That was the one thing that wasn't better yet. And now I'm better because my labrum's fixed. And so my approach is simply just do it at the same time because it's the same rehab and it doesn't add much time if you use the same table and you move right on through. Now it's controversial because not everybody is a hip arthroscopist and an open surgeon. So there are open surgeons who don't do hip arthroscopy. There are hip arthroscopists who don't do open surgery. And so you get a lot of situations where there's a staged scope in PAO. So they wait a few weeks between. And I think that's kind of tough on the patients. It's two anesthesias. It's two recoveries. It's, you know, two surgeries. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of the PAO surgeons say, well, the data shows that you don't need to do the hip scope because they're going to do just fine afterwards. But I would argue, and again, this is controversial, I'm probably going to get some phone calls about this, but if an open surgeon who's not an arthroscopic surgeon is doing the hip scope, again, that technique matters. And so they're probably not doing the same thing that a very skilled arthroscopic surgeon is doing as far as repairing the labrum, repairing the capsule, taking care of everything that needs to be taken care of. And so that might be skewing some of the data.
Yeah, good point.
So that was a really good point about whether or not you can do an isolated PAO, but what about an isolated hip scope in the setting of dysplasia? So our next paper is a study from HSS where you did both your sports fellowship and then another year of hip preservation fellowship. And this study investigated the impact of prior hip arthroscopic surgery on clinical outcomes after PAO. And they found that patients that had a history of a prior scope had inferior hip-specific functional outcomes. Yet there's also literature suggesting that people with borderline hip dysplasia, though I don't see anything that classifies exactly what that is, can do well with arthroscopic surgery alone. So what are your thoughts on this controversial topic? Are there patients that you would say, let's try a scope and see how you do because you're borderline, or because you do PAO and scope, would you just kind of do it all together?
So for somebody who doesn't do hip arthroscopy, you're hitting on like the hottest topic in hip preservation surgery.
Good job.
So the borderline hip dysplastic patient is a really challenging cohort. And you're right, there's not a clear definition. Some people will say it's a lateral center edge angle of between 18 and 25. Other people will say it's between 20 and 25. That's not even accounting for the tonus angle or their femoral version, which we talked about earlier. So kind of a gray zone. But one argument that I have is there is really good literature in very high volume, very talented, skilled hip arthroscopy surgeons that say you can do well with hip arthroscopy in borderline patients. But what they're doing is they're doing a watertight capsule closure every time. They're doing a perfect labral repair. They're not taking too much bone away from the acetabular rim or the femoral head. And in those patients, their patients can do better, right? They can do well without the PAO. But I think the problem is when you're not getting a perfect capsule closure, you're accidentally taking a little too much bone, you're making them more unstable, then that goes into the paper that you were citing where now this patient has a failed hip arthroscopy and they're going on to their PAO. What we typically see is that in the interim, they've retorn their labrum, they've gone on to have further edge loading and further damage of the cartilage. And so now they're in a worse situation than they were prior to the first hip scope. And their outcomes after that PAO, that definitive procedure, are worse. And so you know, my approach is there are certainly some patients who have a borderline dysplastic hip. If they have a low Batten score, they're not hypermobile, they have a really big CAM. So the impingement is the predominant low-hanging fruit here. They might be okay if the, you know, the capsule is treated very carefully and they get a hip arthroscopy. But if there's any question, I think more and more in my practice, I'm getting having a lower threshold to just say, let's just do the right thing the first time. Let's not mm-hmm. mess with just soft tissue work when the bony issue is the issue.
Yeah,
I think that's really important. I also think it's you educate your patients and you let them make a decision sometimes, right? I think it's like, again, I reference everything with the knee, but talking about like the addition of an LET to an ACL, right? Like you say, it could lower your risk if people are willing to accept that additional incision and maybe more pain postoperatively. And a lot of people are. They're like, I don't never want to go through this again. And so I feel like if you put it that way, I think a lot of people would choose the PAO with the hip scope. They want one and done. They don't want to be back here on this table. So
yeah,
that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. So we've been talking a lot about acetabulum, and we did briefly touch on version, but we want to get a little deeper there. As far as like antiversion, retroversion, can you explain a little bit to the listeners, specifically our physical therapists, like what is that? You know, what, you know, how does that affect the hip? Like what sort of symptoms do people present with you know, out sort of the normal version?
So the version in general, and it's a lot more complicated than I'm going to explain, but it's good. Basically the angle. I'll keep it general. It's the angle at which the femoral neck comes off of the femoral shaft or the thigh bone. And so on average, people have about 15 to 20 degrees of femoral antiversion. So it's pointing forward. And so when you have high femoral antiversion, you'll probably notice that the patient is in toeing. So, and the reason is because their hip is pointing out the front of the socket, they're rotating their toes in to try to get it tucked into the socket. And when you have high retroversion, when the femur is pointing backwards, you'll notice that the foot is pointing outwards. It's externally rotating when the patient is moving, and that's because they're rotating the hip into a more normal position. And I'd say antiversion tends to be higher in females. We also know that if a patient is dysplastic, they tend to have higher antiversion than just a non-dysplastic patient. And then retroversion is more common in males, and that can really exacerbate cam type impingement, which is also more common in males. So we kind of see it go together. But I think the foot progression angle is really helpful when evaluating patients. The other thing that is coming to light is tibial torsion. And so you have to think about, you know, not just the femur bone, but then the tibia bone and if it has torsion. And that's a little bit more of a gray area because the normal tibial torsion is somewhere between 0 and 40. And so, you know, it's a wider spectrum, but also something to think about.
Are you getting specific imaging to look for version? You mentioned the looking at their walking and their gait analysis, but is there something you're getting like CT scan wise or something to look at that version and see if it's something that needs to be surgically corrected?
Yeah, absolutely. So every patient of mine who gets hip preservation surgery, so either the hip arthroscopy or PAO, we have them get a 3D CT scan prior to mm-hmm. surgery. And, you know, I'm well aware, I'm very aware of, I have a young patient population, a female patient population. I don't want to expose them to additional radiation if I don't have to. But we've worked with our radiologists here. We have a low dose protocol. So it's, you know, similar to 2 to 3 x-rays worth of radiation. And so very minimal. And it does give us that information about femoral version and tibial torsion. So we actually go top of the femur, distal femur, take a slice, top of the tibia, take a slice, and then distal tibia, take a slice. And so we can measure both of those things. And so with every patient, I'm factoring that in and considering a femoral derotational osteotomy. Now we're considering tibial torsional osteotomies. And it also helps me actually change the location of my scope portals, depending on what their femoral version is.
Okay. So talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah.
So if you think about when a patient's lying supine on an arthroscopy table, if they are antiverted and their toes are pointing up, their femoral head is kind of pointing up as well. So your scope portals can be a little bit more lateral and you can reach the head. Whereas if they're retroverted and you have the toes pointing up or slightly internally rotated, now the hip is almost pointing away from you. And so you have to cheat some of your portals a little bit higher up to follow the neck down. And for me, I use a DALA, a distal anterolateral accessory portal. And so that especially applies to that distal portal where you want to place your anchors and do the cam decompression.
Very cool. Yeah, no, that's a great nugget. Go ahead, Ashley.
No, that's perfect. I was going to actually transition to the next paper because I'm really excited to hear about that open surgical hip dislocation. So we've been talking about the addition of an arthroscopy to some of these open procedures to address intra-articular pathology, but sometimes intra-articular pathology can or maybe should be managed via an open approach. So your paper talked about doing an open surgical hip dislocation with the addition of a labrum reconstruction for management of coxa profunda. So can you talk to our listeners a little bit about what are your indications for doing an open surgical hip dislocation? Like what kind of pathology are you typically managing with that?
So the open surgical hip dislocation is also fantastic anatomy. If you remember from last week when you did your last one.
Exactly. Yes. It's from my memory.
But it is a really great surgery. And it's so interesting because when femoral acetabular impingement was first described by Reinhold Gans, this was how they treated it. So every FAI patient got a surgical hip dislocation, an open labral repair, and an open cam resection. And slowly as arthroscopy came onto the scene and we got better tools, we got better at doing it, we got better at training our fellows and residents, surgical hip dislocation has really fallen by the wayside. So really there, now I think I only use it for a very, very select few diagnoses, and coxa profunda or a lateral center edge angle greater than 40, a deep hip socket is one of those indications. And I think other indications, Perthes is a very common one, because Perthes, you get a football-shaped head, you get a high-riding trochanter. And in these cases, hip arthroscopy is challenging. So sometimes you can't get into the joint in these, you can't distract it enough. And the other thing about hip arthroscopy is that with the exception of a very select few hip arthroscopists, it's really challenging to get a global access to the hip joint through arthroscopic portals. And so the surgical hip dislocation, it's muscle sparing. It utilizes a trochanteric flip osteotomy so that you cut the lateral edge of the trochanter so you can kind of lift the muscles up and then get down to the hip capsule, perform a capsulotomy, and then literally dislocate the hip out of the hip socket. And that allows 360-degree access to the hip socket. You can do, as we described in our paper with coxa profunda, you can do a global rim resection. So you literally take a chisel and you just chisel off all the extra rim that's not supposed to be there. And then in a lot of those cases, the labrum is really minuscule, or it has turned to bone with the rim. And so then a labral reconstruction, you can do it all the way around from the transverse acetabular ligament front to back. Putting in, I use a tibialis anterior allograft, and then you can anchor that in around the rim, and then you do an open cam resection, put the hip back in, fold that trochanteric flip osteotomy back on, put screws back in it, and then the patient is good to go. It's a big surgery, big incision in my hands, and a longer recovery. But if you look back at the old FAI literature, all of those patients were getting surgical hip dislocations, and they're, they demonstrated pretty decent long-term outcomes, that they're maintaining their hip.
As far as, and this is more of just like a technical detail question, but whether you're doing a scope or you're doing this open, are you changing like what anchors you use? Is it all the same? How do you change that up?
I actually use the same anchors in an open labral repair or labral reconstruction as I do arthroscopically. And my preference is just the smallest anchors there are out there. And it's because you don't have a lot of real estate on the rim. And so, I think every once in a while an anchor will pull out or something goes wrong with it. And I don't like those really big holes in the rim. So I prefer really small anchors.
What is the size nowadays?
1.4 millimeters.
Wow. Nice. Okay.
You mentioned tibialis anterior allograft, and that was what was used in your paper. Are you doing that for both arthroscopic and open labrum reconstruction?
I am. The other more popular allograft for labral reconstruction would be tensor fascia lata. And I think one of the reasons that tibialis anterior, people say that sometimes it takes up a little bit more water and can get a little bit boggier, but I haven't really seen that if you get a smaller tibialis anterior. And it's small is key because, tibialis anterior that we use in other surgeries, oftentimes we're looking for like 6 millimeters or bigger. And sometimes that can overstuff the hip. So we're looking for a little bit of a smaller graft size.
And you, as far as your technique paper, it really nicely describes the whole procedure. We're going to make sure that there's plenty of graphics on YouTube, as well as like Ashley will put it all up in social media, because it is really good and people should check it out. But what are your main sort of takeaways and tips for any surgeons who are listening as far as adding this approach to their repertoire?
So, the surgical hip dislocation actually is something that I think trauma surgeons can use for access to the joint for acetabular fractures. And so, I think partnering with a trauma surgeon is a great way to go if you have a case that you think needs a surgical hip dislocation. That's a great way to start. And then if it's something that, you like to do, once you've learned the technique, it is pretty straightforward, a straightforward approach. But I would say, again, it's pretty rare that a patient needs this. So, some of those, really big deformities like Perthes, hip deformities, coxa profunda, coxa protrusio, those might be those indications. But, man, we're getting really good at arthroscopic surgery. So we don't need to do this all that often.
So the takeaway is, if you're thinking about it, guys, just send it to Andrea.
Yeah.
don't do it. Don't make it your N of one for the next decade. Awesome. So now we want to move on to Catherine's favorite topic, which is post-op recovery and rehab and return to play. So for ease, let's just focus on PAO since surgical hip dislocation is very rare. So, you know, I'm seeing a lot of young athletes with hip issues in the setting of dysplasia. And if they fail conservative treatment, I'm sending them to a hip surgeon, but I don't have the benefit of seeing how they do and if they are able to get back into play and when that is. So let's start with maybe just their rehab. What does their early recovery look like? When do you allow them to do like sport-specific drills and running?
And do you want me to comment on both femoroacetabular impingement and PAOs?
That would be great, yeah.
Okay, so, and you know, it's interesting because the PAO recovery initially, I think a lot of the restrictions that we put on those patients have to do with the hip arthroscopy and protecting the capsule and soft tissue. Mm-hmm. So I think you could be a little bit more lenient if you didn't do the hip arthroscopy in that PAO patient. But typically for hip arthroscopy, the key is to really protect your capsule closure and your labral repair. And so that is that 20% weight bearing for 2 to 3 weeks right after surgery. And I get my patients into physical therapy within a couple of days of surgery. So they're right off the bat getting back into PT. At 6 weeks, again, for this is for hip arthroscopy alone. At 6 weeks, we can start to stretch the hip because I think the capsule and the labrum should be healed enough that it can sustain some of that stretching. And so getting rid of those motion restrictions that we have for the first 6 weeks, namely no hyperextension, no external rotation beyond 30, that goes away at 6 weeks. And then at 3 months, about 12 weeks post-op, then the capsule and labrum should be healed enough that it can withstand impact activity. So we start running and jumping. And then a lot of my in-season athletes, I am clearing for full restriction somewhere between 4 and 6 months after surgery, faster than an ACL.
Yeah. Wow.
So, and that part is that technically at 3 months, they have no restrictions anymore. And it's just a matter of ramping up their endurance and strength for the next month to 3 months. And it differs based on sport. Now with the PAO, in addition to the soft tissue, so in most of my PAOs, I'm doing a hip arthroscopy at the same time. So I still want to be cognizant of the labrum and the capsule protection, but I place them in crutches for 6 weeks at 20% weight bearing. And in part, you know, this fragment should be stable. It's got strong fixation with screws, but we do want to be sure that we're not going to create stress risers through the intact bone or dislodge that fragment or, you know, any of those issues at all. So 6 weeks, 20% weight bearing. And then as soon as they hit that 6 week mark, they can get off of crutches. They don't have any motion restrictions because again, we're following the hip arthroscopy protocol. And then if they're healed at 3 months, same with the hip arthroscopy protocol, we can start impact activity. Healing, you know, patients younger than 20 is pretty reliable and they do a great job by 3 months. Once we get into our older patients, that's one of the big problems with the PAO, especially our 30 and 40 year old females. Sometimes we see non-union as an issue with a periacetabular osteotomy and there we'll base our PT progression on how the bone is doing.
Okay. And is there any other adjuncts that you have to add generally as far as like medication or supplementation?
In both hip arthroscopy and PAOs, we use indomethacin 75 milligrams daily for the first 4 days to prevent heterotopic ossification. So the hip is really vascular. And so doing hip surgery, pretty high risk of getting HO up to 20% before the institution of indomethacin. And with indomethacin, it drops down to less than 2% chance. So it really makes a difference. So 4 days of that right after surgery with a hip scope, I don't use any braces, no CPM, but with a PAO, we do use a CPM machine 3 times a day for about 2 hours for about the first 6 weeks. But then I tell patients, if you're going to get up and move, don't strap yourself back down into the bed to use your CPM, you know, get up and move. And it's amazing that you think it's a little counterintuitive, but those patients, when they're using that CPM, their hip feels a lot better because I think stiffness is kind of the problem in the beginning. So getting it moving really helps.
No, that's awesome. And then I think last sort of thing, when do you say, you said return to impact, but like, as far as do you caution them, like, I don't want you really running. I don't really want you, you know, pounding, jumping until a little bit later, or it's really just go ahead and progress as tolerated.
It really is go ahead and progress. And all the ACL surgeons out there are like, what? This is why hip is so amazing. Yes. Because, you know, structurally, this is a better joint than they had before surgery. You know, there's no impingement, there's more stability. And so, yes, once we think all the soft tissue should be healed, we can start progressing. Now, big things that we see if they go too fast, the hip flexors overreact. And so that's something that we caution them. You know, if your hip flexors start flaring up, it means you're going too fast too soon. And again, remember, a lot of them have kind of glutes that are shut down. And so they probably have this overreactive hip flexor in the beginning. So kind of, you know, basing your progression on how are the muscles waking back up is really important.
That's really interesting you say that they, you know, you don't hold them back and that they can do so well, because there was a paper that came out in AJSM this year looking at that, and they found that sports participation increased, duration of exercise increased, and then frequency of sports per during the week increased as well too. And I was like, I had to read it again. Like, I have to have the group switched, because it doesn't make sense. Like, the PAO is such a huge procedure. I mean, I can't imagine that they would do more. Maybe they get back to their same level, but as you're saying, like, when the hip is now in its correct position it was supposed to be in all along, they really can do all these sports and activities. So it really is profound. So then kind of leading into that, what is the return to play rate that you typically see? You know, is it really high? Is it like above 90? Is it kind of in between? What are you typically seeing in your patient population?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting question, because historically, there hasn't been much on the return to play rate after a periostabular osteotomy. Mm-hmm. And I think in many people's minds, it's a career-ending surgery, right? So they'll tell people, if you have dysplasia, just run through your career before you get a PAO. But I think finally we're looking at return to play, and there have been some recent studies looking specifically at scope plus PAO, and it looks like the return to play is higher with scope plus PAO than it is in the previously reported literature that was PAO alone. And I think it's you know, mostly in the mid-70s for PAO alone, and then it's in the upper 80% patients, 86% or something, that go back to sport at the same or higher level if they have a scope plus PAO. And again, it's not a perfect study, you know, it's comparing older studies to newer studies, but again, that in my mind is, it speaks to that. We were talking about that a little bit earlier, like maybe the PAO makes them better, but they still have pain related to impingement and a labral tear that can be fixed with a concomitant hip arthroscopy.
Interesting.
That all this has been so helpful, and we've already kept you like over what we said we were going to keep you. But the last thing we do, and I promise this is the last thing, is we do something called the Fast Five, which is just asking you five quick questions. We ask them to every surgeon we have. And it's just about some basic sort of things. So we're going to close with that. But I know Ashley feels just as I do. Like, we're so happy to have you on. As we said at the top of the first episode, we've been avoiding a hip episode for a really long time, just because it's less so in our wheelhouse. But I've learned a ton. I know our listeners will like learn a ton. And we really appreciate all the time you spent with us this evening.
Yeah, this has been great. I think people of all levels, like orthopedists, medical students, residents, PTs, can all appreciate the knowledge in this episode. So thank you so much.
Yeah, you're a fantastic educator, for sure.
Yes, you really are.
Thank you. Ashley, you want to keep going?
Do you want me to start?
Either way, you go.
Okay. All right. So in the OR, are you doing foot pedal or hand control?
Mostly foot pedal. The only exception is every once in a while with the radiofrequency ablation device, I'll switch to hand if I need to use it really quickly.
I'm a foot pedal always. Mm-hmm. And then I just had someone who was so tall that when I was doing a shoulder arthroscopy, no matter with my boots and all that sort of stuff, I had to use a step stool the other day because their torso is just so gigantic. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I'll just use hand control so we don't have to deal with the step stool and the pedal and all that sort of stuff. And I was like, God, this is awful.
That's why I do hand control, because like anytime I'm doing like lateral or even beach chair, I'm always on step stools. So like I can't do that.
I would need to build a hip arthroscopy, and the patient's just at the level that you set the table, wherever that is.
Very true. Awesome.
All right. So what shoes do you wear in the OR, Andrea?
I have forever and probably always will be a Dansko wearer, clogs.
Yeah.
What is your favorite OR lounge snack?
We just started getting snacks in our lounge, and they have been giving us cheese sticks. And maybe it's because I live in Wisconsin, but cheese sticks are awesome.
That's awesome.
What type of music do you play in the OR?
Anything but country.
We hear that
really
one a
get
lot.
Along. ABC. You really get along with my with my scrub tech.
Yeah. That's literally, that was like, that was Brett Owens' answer too, right? He said ABC, anything but country.
Nice.
What is your favorite surgery?
So, in the hip, it's hip arthroscopy. It is so challenging. It is so satisfying when patients do well. I feel like maybe I'm, on the Star Trek Voyager going into the final frontier because this is a new area of sports medicine, but I really enjoy hip arthroscopy. And in the knee, I really like the ACL and meniscal work.
Absolutely.
All right, last question. And so Ashley actually came up with this one, so I'll give her credit. But so you've published a lot on the increasing number of students taking a research gap year before pursuing residency. We have a lot of medical students that listen to our podcast, and I'm sure they're curious about this. So as an academic surgeon who is also a program director, what do you think? Should they take a gap year or not?
So, maybe less so as a surgeon and a program director, but more so as a human being in orthopedic surgery. I say, why not? It's a great year, and once you go down the path of residency and attendingship and fellowship, I mean, there's really it's hard to stop once you go down that path. And so, a research year, after medical school, during medical school, it's a fantastic year to really learn how to do clinical research, which I think then makes it easier to do when you're a busy resident or a busy fellow or a busy attending. And so if it works out well for you in your life, take a year, do research, beef up your CV, have fun during that year, and then get back to it.
Awesome.
I think that's great advice. That's great advice.
Well, thank you again so much. It's been awesome having you, and I know everybody's going to learn a lot. So, and then hopefully, are you coming out to Colorado for AOSSM?
Yep, I'll be
All right,
there.
good. All right, and Boston, Anna.
Yep,
Nice to
I'll
meet
be
you.
there too.
Awesome. Good. We'll see you at all those things.
Yeah, we'll see you there. Awesome. Well, have a great night.
Yeah, thank you both so much. I've had so much fun and great job with this podcast. So educational, and I'm honored to have been a guest.
Thank
Thank
you.
you.
Good night.
Good night.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Sports Docs. We hope you enjoyed the discussion as much as we did. Make sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, now on YouTube to stay up to date on all things sports medicine. If you like what you hear, please consider leaving us a review or a comment. You can also reach us by email at thesportsdocspod@gmail.com or find us on Instagram at thesportsdocspod and Twitter at thesportsdocpod. We love your feedback.